Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation I'm hoping helps your business grow. Medicine and innovation, it's a big industry. It is a big hot topic. All kinds of people involved in it. Everybody uses it, and the United States spends the most on it in sometimes ways that are not maybe the most effective and could usually use a little bit of innovation. So that's what we're going to get into today. Before I introduce today's guest, quick reminder that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. With me today, I've got Dr. Greg Ator. He is the Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the University of Kansas Health System. For those of you that are listening outside of the Kansas City area, which is most of our audience, even though that's my hometown, KU Medical Center is all over Kansas City. My sister went to KU Medical and got a medical degree. And if you're local, you hear it everywhere. And they do some really amazing stuff. We're going to talk all about that today. First, I should say, Doctor, welcome to Startup Hustle.
Matt, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Now, normally I've got tech company founders on here, and I usually say the CEO and the founder tells the backstory better than anyone else. But in your case, I'm going to have to say that the CMIO probably tells the story a little better. What's your backstory, and what brought you to that role at KU Med Center?
Okay, well, it's actually been a great ride. I first kind of got involved with technology, actually, in my undergrad days. I'm an electrical engineer, and so I actually never worked as a engineer other than, you know, some summer gigs. But basically, my goal was to go to medical school early on in my career. And I think I'm a pretty good example of why a diversity of background is a good thing in all sorts of pursuits, including medicine. This engineering background sort of led me to get involved with technical things. And then when the EMR, and even I can even go back and remember the start of the internet and the browsers, the first Mozilla, I believe it was, browsers, and just how I saw the potential impact on medicine. So I teamed up with some business folks at our institution, and about 2003, we put our first EMR product in the institution, and we are now kind of on essentially our third, probably big vendor. And that project went live in about 2005. So it's been a couple of decades of experience with really the CMIO role, Chief Medical Informatics. There are other designations for it, but really we are the interface between the technology and the provider at the front line. So we're trying to translate technology into what the physician needs or wants to do in the office with the patient. The goal being better care. You know, how do we use technology to improve care? And you mentioned the spend. The U.S. spends a lot of money on healthcare, and a lot of that is waste. And so how do we use, for instance, the technology to stop doing things that don't matter and do the things that do matter for healthcare?
So EMR, what's that?
EMR is electronic medical record. So, you know, that's the right. Transactional system that docs use on every patient every day it's a note-taking system right now. It is starting to do more and more things, and it needs to do a lot more to get doctors to where most of them want to be, which is doing good medicine all the time for every patient.
We always say that good software, good businesses, really anything worthwhile solves a problem. I think that if anyone could solve the problem of why do I have to fill out the same forms every time I go to the doctor, I think we could probably get a lot of people behind that. But what you're referring to is more along the lines of the notes, the everything that occurs either before or after I come and see you or a doctor in the exam room.
Well, that's right. That what you referred to there initially is the whole concept of interoperability. So, you know, there have been a lot of government money thrown at the idea that everyone needs an EMR. And I think we actually in Kansas, I think the latest stats, they're old from 4 years ago, is that 93% of the practices have technology. So, you know, we have technology, and now the challenge is what to do with it to really move the ball down the field towards better care, healthier patients. And then, of course, in there, we've got the burnout problem with providers as well. So ideally, you know, you could almost think of like a Bloomberg terminal concept where, you know, there are systems that are going out and talking to all these data sources in the community nationally, and then bringing it back as you're taking care of a patient and recommending various treatment courses, discussing the pros and cons of a particular medicine, throw in a little pharmacogenetics, maybe understanding what they're going to respond to before you do it. So it's kind of like getting rid of some of the art of medicine and you know, maintaining a human touch, but also you know, improving our science on every patient every day.
So was the original problem with that just like handwritten notes that were not transferable, or you couldn't see them from one doctor to the other, or they required too much input manually? Or I mean, what's the most basic problem that needed to be solved to make EMR a little more usable or feasible?
Well, I think the what we should be striving for is data as a byproduct of care, rather than the kind of the current paradigm is, you know, the doctor sees the patient and then they, you know, it's hard, but sometimes the idea of recording the whole thing while you're in the room with the patient, you know, there's a lot of cartoons about the doctor, you know, the patient's looking at the top of the doctor's head while the doctor is tending to the technology. But if we can imagine things artificial intelligence recording our conversation a la Alexa or one of those assistants, and you know, the note comes out as a at the end of the conversation, and it's not a deposition style transcript, but it is a interpretation of what happened. You can imagine that right now the doc has to listen to the patient and then typically go out in between patients and enter all that stuff into the record, and that is, you know, really not an optimal way to do it. We do have some tools. Different vendors have the ability to automate, you know, stuff that you say a lot as a provider. In other words, maybe risk and benefits around a particular medicine. But ideally, we would like, and we are piloting this at KU right now, is a product that essentially listens in on the conversation. And then when the doc is done, the note is done. And you can imagine if you added a doctor or maybe up on a screen or some sort of interaction, the doctor, you should ask him about that visit they had with Dr. So-and-so last week. And what do they think about that? And, you know, so it's this idea that if we can get the information moving around the community, you know, with appropriate safeguards around privacy and security, when the doctor is seeing the patient, it's not a matter of let's clean it up afterwards. That's a little bit about, you know, some of the thing in the population health world right now, where the doctor sees a patient. And then afterwards, we kind of have people that scurry around and clean up, you know, all the things that maybe didn't get talked about. But you can imagine that if while you're having a conversation, these things are fed to the doctor, and then they right at that point when the doctor and the patient are having a good conversation, the computer can help the doctor, you know, make good decisions. So automation would be a fabulous thing in that space.
So according to my notes here, there are almost 800,000 different companies in the U.S. healthcare sector. Why is KU Medical Center tackling problems like these and not just pushing that back out to the world of like the Cerners or startups or whomever?
Well, we actually use Epic at our shop, which is a very comparable product to Cerner. Those are kind of the number one and two, you know, probably worldwide. The problems that the Epics and the Cerners of the world have is they are transactional systems they have many, many masters, let's just say. And the doctor and the patient and healthcare are there, but, you know, you also have to do the legal community and defensive medicine, the billing folks. You know, don't throw me in jail for not billing correctly, even though I can't keep up with all the rules of that. You've got the insurance company. So there are many consumers of the notes, and that flavors how the note and the interaction that the provider has with it. So unfortunately, we're having to solve a lot of these problems. And of course, we are very much interested in partnering with startups in Kansas City and elsewhere. But I think, you know, there's a certain complexity in how medicine rolls that people need to understand. And the more you know about that, I think the better your solution can fit with, you know, what we're having to deal with, just as far as seeing the next patient, you know, because all that stuff about the consumers of the record, all of that stuff has to be addressed as I am seeing patients. And the patients are, you know, nobody likes to wait. Nobody likes to wait on your doctor. Everybody, you know, wants to, you know, get on with their day. And, you know, that unfortunately, all this other stuff doctors have to do slows them down. And really, again, the burnout thing I mentioned, EMR is blamed for burnout in some circles, but I don't think it's the problem in most places. There are lots of administrative stuff though that is to blame outside of medicine. So with
data apparently being the most valuable thing on the planet these days, medical data is a completely different animal. You know, you have HIPAA requirements and all this other stuff. How much harder does that make all of it when it comes to innovation? The fact that the data, I mean, it's almost, for lack of a better term, it's almost radioactive. I mean, it needs to be handled so much differently. And if it's out there in the world, That's where that kind of poisonous nature, people don't want their medical records out. How much does that slow down innovation or just change the entire approach?
Well, I think, you know, it is appropriate, I think, to have safeguards on data. And my personal opinion is I believe that patients, should have the ability to say what happens to their data. And, you know, if they want to extend it to a company working on an innovative treatment for a cancer, then I think they need to have an informed consent and be able to do that. And, you know, the patient should be in control of their data. And, of course, we are embracing that in healthcare. But I think the HIPAA and other regulations, you know, are good. I think they do sometimes slow us down, but it does get back to what I said a moment ago about folks that seek to innovate in the healthcare space need to just understand that HIPAA is here to stay, and we need to respect patients' right to control their data. I don't know. I think it does. You know, there's a lot of fear with, you know, certain companies' interpretations of the HIPAA rules and regs. You know, we get in a big organization like ours with over 2,000 doctors, you know, sometimes we have multiple compliance camps with multiple opinions about how we take care of the privacy. And particularly billing rules, you know, that's another big piece is the billing folks tend to, operate in a paper world where, you know, we have an electronic record, and actually, if you try to print out an electronic medical record, it doesn't work very well. So, you know, it's not just HIPAA, but I think it's the other, regulatory environment that we have to deal with that really causes the challenges.
All right, so a little change of lane here. Since we are talking about medicine and innovation in general, once again, I'm here with Dr. Greg Ator, the Chief Medical Informatics Officer at the University of Kansas Health System. There is a link in the show notes. You can go to kansashealthsystem.com. And as a quick reminder, today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. And that's where my question's going. So, you know, doctors are in short supply, not only here, but lots of other places. So are software developers. And, you know, my business employs hundreds of them in the Philippines, where they are far less scarce. But overall in the US, there's on any given day between 300 and 400,000 open IT jobs in the US. How difficult does that kind of shortage, and is that creating problems for medicine and innovation?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, the whole workforce problem, because you said it earlier on, Matt, and I love it, that idea that software can solve problems. And I think the challenge in medicine is that the problem to be solved in some cases is pretty complex. So you need pretty high level developers. And right. What we're trying to do in our organization is bring our providers, get them sufficient training in the technical spaces, not to make them developers, but to make them better able to work with our Epic counterparts and our Epic technical backend. Because in our shop, you know, we don't write software so much. We configure the software that Epic it's the same for Cerner. You know, you have thousands, even hundreds of thousands of decisions are configuration switches in these very complex software products. And, you know, you have to choose the right thing so that it will work properly for the providers, the nurses, and the other staff. I think there is, with the advent of something called FHIR, which is Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources, It's a great technology that has just come on the scene relatively recently that allows for that interoperability piece that I talked about. And so for a developer to try to attack a small part of the problem and then, you know, allow it to interact with the transactional EMR system. So the developers, we need developers that have a fair understanding of these challenges of medical health, medical software, and then a technical, you know, background to put it together. We are fortunate being here in Kansas City that Cerner, you know, has a huge workforce here, and there is a lot of folks that I think are, with us. What we tend to need, though, is so you need developers, but also informatics people that understand, you know, how technology and healthcare go together. So it's an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't consider the fact that software, even as a quote final product, often needs significant configuration, like you mentioned. And, you know, you look at a company like, not medical, but Salesforce has become one of the biggest companies in the world. And, you know, like, there's a huge demand for Salesforce developers. What do? They configure the product because there's that many bells and whistles. I learned this firsthand as the founder of Gigabook, where we build a fully customizable booking platform. And we're like, wow, what a strength. And then we realized that was also our biggest weakness, because that's usually the way strengths work, that your biggest strength is often your biggest weakness. But yeah, and that's a really, really, I think, unknown thing for a lot of people. So you hear things like AR, augmented reality, virtual reality, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and we've been using these terms and throwing them around for quite a while. At the same time, this is for the most, in the timeline of software and technology, a newborn, you know, like, and that's what makes finding people that know how to do it so difficult. And, you know, I spent many days talking to people that, you know, they'll say, well, I need a senior developer that does this, and the thing's only been out for 3 years. And I'm like, that's not even possible. Like, you can't do it. Now, when it comes to AI and stuff like that, you know, in theory, it makes decisions based on logic. But I have a feeling that in a lot of cases, it isn't the diagnostic part of a doctor's job where it can have a lot of sway, meaning like three doctors might think it has three different problems.
Right.
How does the world of tech begin to work with that? You know, it's like I said, it's like you really can get three different you might want to get a second opinion. That line exists for a reason. So how is that handled? And I mean, how are we going to get through that?
Yeah. Well, I think you need folks like me. I'll just, maybe I'm a little biased, but, you know, people that understand the technology and understand, the problems. And, you know, AI is, said to solve all kinds of problems. I mean, I drive a Tesla, and it does a pretty decent job on the basics of driving. I think we need in healthcare more transparency in the algorithms, how they are working, and kind of maybe intermediate. You know, the whole black box idea of let's digest all of KU Med's healthcare records, and then, you know, let's massage them. I think that's actually been tried. I think Google did it with a number of institutions. And, you know, I think we need to tread carefully. To answer your question, I think we've really got to understand the problem and, you know, kind of walk before we run. We are forming a group because all, you know, we've got, as I mentioned, 1,000 staff doctors, you know, twice that overall. And everyone's getting emails about how AI is going to solve your problems. And, you know, we're trying to kind of develop a clearinghouse so that we can, you know, help folks deploy the technology appropriately and without any surprises. You know, because in healthcare, we don't we don't, drive by the seat of our pants. You know, I mean, we really do, we need to be safe. We are, have a fiduciary almost responsibility for healthcare of our patients. And we want to make sure that those algorithms are doing what they are purported to do, what they're sold to do. And so I think it's a real challenge to, make sure that the overall product is safe and is doing what the clinician and their patient think it's doing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people misunderstand AI in the regards that, it does, in the very early stages of anything that involves machine learning, people have to kind of tell the machine whether it's right or wrong. I mean, it doesn't really know. They're very binary in the regards that, it's a win or a loss or a true or a false. And then when it comes to the higher levels of things, and I know this because I've built machine learning products that we use for a number of things. And if they learn the wrong stuff, it's really hard to unteach them. You have to basically start over. And, right. That's the challenge with that. So, all right. So, of course, we're sitting here talking about medicine and innovation, which could be its own 10,000 part series. We could probably never hit the bottom of that conversation. But one thing that I wanted to make sure we got onto that I think is really, really interesting is nanomedicine. And, do you know who Stephen Kurzweil is? Or I believe it's Stephen. He's been a big outspoken advocate or just voice on singularity, the bonding of man and machine. And, talking about how the world of technology can get the computing power of something like similar to what you have, the smartphone you have in your pocket, in the next 10 years will be able to be as compact as something that's the size or relative size of a red blood cell. So what is where are you guys doing anything with nanomedicine? And is that reality and something that we will see in our lifetime?
Well, I think, that is a topic that I'm not all that familiar with, actually. I'm a little bit more in just right now. I mean, we do have folks that are kind of in the innovation space for sure, and I'm involved with that. We're spending a lot of time right now just on the whole, human interface, the ability to get out of the system what you need to take care of the patient in front of you. I would love to have data around, what a particular patient has and how it compares to the other patients that I personally have treated. So I think what I would be, the analytics that would go with such a concept that you describe, and how to apply that technology to the right problem, I think is one of the key questions. How do we deploy something like that, and where in a health system like ours? Currently we are in the Midwest, and a lot of our compensation systems are more of the old school, the fee for service type of model, rather than a outcomes driven model. And so our insurance companies and the payers are coming along. But it's kind of, you've got a great tool like that, and how do you deploy it for optimal impact on a patient is one of the questions. So that does sound quantum computing, another area that I think holds great promise. And the single to noise problem in medicine is pretty significant, right? As far as, where is the important information in this sea of data that I have? That's an exciting area though, for sure.
Yeah, I think the early cusp of that you're seeing is just simple wearables. You've got the Apple iWatch and stuff like that, which, one thing when it comes to medicine, and I'm not going to pretend to be anywhere near your pay grade on it, just general fascination and honestly things I've learned from this show. But, you know, one of the things that a past guest brought up was that medicine is often reactive and you use the heart, a heart attack. So here you are, my arm hurts, my chest hurts. And now that you're in the ambulance, and talking about the current technology, and they had used the Apple Watch as an example of being able to gather data, process it, and say, hey, you know, basically signal the user, you should probably go to the hospital now,
right?
You know, rather than when it's already occurring. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that works, how that happens, and how that comes down the line. It seems to be coming pretty quickly. I mean, it looks to me as if, you know, even just the current versions of some of that hardware can give you some tremendous insights into what is occurring now, storage, processing data, and all of that. You know, I've had people on the show talk about being big advocates of that being stored in the blockchain. And, yeah. You know, I don't know if that's realistic or possible. Is that something that you're hearing discussed in and around your circles?
Yes. Well, the whole blockchain concept, I think there's incredible opportunity there. Back to one of the concepts I mentioned about putting the patient in charge of their data and understanding how it flows, you know, so, you know, the ability to really curate what has happened to your medical record. And the idea that, you know, we could almost have our records live in the cloud, and then we partition them, our portion them out to different providers, you know, at our, on our, you know, on our say-so. And I think is a incredible opportunity. The blockchain, you know, I've actually seen it recently around the hacker problem that we have with folks all over the world wanting to get into our computing systems. And, you know, so how do we establish an immutable archive and then, you know, put a wrapper around it, blockchain, you know, secure wrapper. And then, you know, we're much able to get back online. That's one of the ongoing, you know, questions, I think, is how do we, you know, deploy those technology. Again, it's a recurring theme, I think, with me is we've got technology and how do we deploy it to the optimal problem and run our business, you know, with the business parameters that we have currently. So,
well, as long as you figure out how to help someone make more money or save more money, then you're usually on the right track. All right. So another thing that's pretty fascinating in the world of medicine and innovation is 3D printing, which, you know, has started with physical things. I was watching a documentary a couple months ago where a machine built a small house just out of concrete, you know, and that was it. And where do you see the future of medicine when it comes to 3D printing, like on the basic, you know, like everyday level for whatever it is that we get done or need to have done?
Yeah, well, we're using that technology right now in reconstructive areas. You can imagine that a high speed crash, in the fragile human body, particularly the facial skeleton, can really be mangled a bit. And so the idea is that the older technology was kind of like an erector set model with straight plates and hundreds of screws, and I'm not exaggerating. The idea, though, of 3D printing is to recreate a number of bone defects de novo, and you know that could be printed in a variety of materials, and then you basically install something that fixes 20 fractures instead of individually repairing those fractures. So hard materials that are 3D printed, skull reconstructions for craniofacial issues is another example. But you can imagine 3D printing of much smaller materials and substrates so that that you're able to deploy those in a customized fashion to the patient we have. Remember, just as our fingerprints and our facial features vary, they even vary from the left side to the right side. Internally, people are different as well. There are certain, fortunately for us surgeons, I'm also an ENT surgeon, you know, the inside of us has some, you know, it's a Gaussian function. You know, there is a range that you can typically expect, but there's always, you know, the one-offs. So that's the challenge, is when you're creating parts, custom parts, they need to be able to fit the patient that you're treating. So I think 3D printing, you know, and not just thinking of the hard stuff, but maybe a cellular structure that you could create to improve various sensory organs could be a real area of opportunity.
Similar question, but slightly different, you know, precision medicine and operation and all of that. What kind of technology and what kind of advances are really taking over when it comes to that? Because it seems to me that if we needed to, that has a lot of promise, because it could be scalable when it came to certain types of procedures or operations, or maybe even just avoiding error.
Yeah. Well, I think the obvious easy one there is response to medications. You know, it would be great if when we're prescribing medications, again, this is a perfect task for a machine-human interface, is you're getting ready to prescribe a medicine, and then you integrate that med with the patient's genetic background. And a number of the medicines, and this is why we get into race and sex-based differences with outcomes in therapy, is there are certain you know, genes that are present that predict non-response to one example is the hypertensive medications. So, you know, don't prescribe. Why do we need to prescribe a medicine that we know, if we look at their genetic profile, they're not going to respond to? And so that's called pharmacogenetics. And that's the idea that at the point of prescribing, you have clinical decision support that helps the doctor, you know, go with a medication that they're going to be more likely to respond to. I think precision medicine, you know, if you sequence the whole genome, you know, you get a lot more information. I really start to get nervous about the privacy and the of that information. And, you know, we need to be very careful. We were talking about privacy and security earlier, but this is really, I think, where we've got a lot of work to do to understand the privacy implications of that. But we could start small and only expose, like I said, that pharmacogenetic information that's around medications, and then, you know, kind of build from there.
Yeah. If you've ever taken a genetic or a DNA test, just even just the simple, you know, spit in the vial and send it in, like, what is it, 23andMe.com, what they send you back is pretty remarkable. And yeah. I would also imagine that's what you're talking about is, I mean, well, first off, processing, comparing, recommending, that's a lot. It's a lot. Now you want to do it in fairly real time, or gotcha. And what you were talking about earlier is maybe even while the doctor's staring at the interface. So as we come to a conclusion here, and I got one more thing to chat about in today's episode. Startup Hustle has been brought to you by fullscale.io, helping you build software teams quickly and affordably. All right. So last week I took my dad to have his pacemaker swapped out, and it was time. The battery had run out. Now he's on his third one, so I have witnessed the changes in technology there. But I got to tell you what, I was shocked with the fact that we got there at just before 9 a.m. and we were in the car on the way to taking him home before 11. I mean, crazy at how quickly and how they were more concerned about the possibility of a bacterial infection in the very small incision they made than they were about at getting it wrong and stopping his heart, you know. And with that, you know, we've seen the evolution of this IoT, and that's what that is. Now, this particular one that they installed, the guy's like, oh, it's okay. It connects to Bluetooth. It's got a cellular thing in it. Like, you know, the prior version, he had to hold a little, you know, plate, or, you know, it's about the size of two fingers over the device, and it would pull data out and pull it back in, which, by the way, they synced to their current computer, and, you know, they pulled all that information out and uploaded it to the next one. I was just so impressed with, I mean, I've had oil changes that took that long. And just the overall advancement with all that, when it comes to IoT and just actual, like we were talking about nanotechnology, that thing's certainly not nano. It's a little smaller than, I don't know. It's probably a terrible example for a cardiac device, but it's smaller than a pack of cigarettes. And you know, what that really was a terrible example for a cardio device, but when it comes to, you know, like IoT and medicine and stuff like that, what will we see in the future, or what's really trending right now?
Yeah, I think this is a great area. And particularly, you mentioned the Apple Watch earlier and all the sensors and data, particularly as we start thinking about more nanomedicine and placing a sensor, maybe you get one sensor, you know, that's a little, you know, grain of rice shaped that gets inserted very easily. And it can sense multiple metabolites and, you know, processes, blood sugar. I mean, if you know, we already have that in terms of the Internet of Things around, you know, glucose sensors and such. The course, I did mention analytics earlier, and you know, the idea that again, I'm really concerned about the provider impact and how we don't make certain things worse. You know, the doctor who hears from the patient, my Apple Watch is telling me thus and such. You know, a lot of it is, you know, we got to be careful that it is that Apple is practicing good medicine when they designed that product, and they had a cardiologist on more than one or two times, you know, interact with the developers. But you know, as we get to the you know, the whole stream of data around us, and you know, this gets back to privacy, but you know, our shopping, our dietary, our credit card information, our Google search, with all the digital breadcrumbs that we create. You can imagine when you throw in the quantified self, that's kind of one terminology around the data that comes away. All of these Internet of Things devices are a lot of them are going to be producing data. And so how do we combine all that together and then present it to the medical decision makers in a way that they can digest it and feel good about it rather than be intimidated by, you know, I mean, for a while we went through, you know, the concept of Google and a computer do not a doctor make. You know, we've just got to be careful, I think, about how we integrate that. But the potential is just enormous, I think, for better medicine.
Do you think that is a possibility down the road? That, you know, you meant, because I, based on everything we've talked about, the small amount that I know is that there could be a level of diagnostic medicine that is performed by machines only. I mean, yeah. some of that stuff seems pretty straightforward. Like, hey, if your blood sugar is really high, eat less sugar.
Yeah. Well, and you know, understanding what you know, what people eat, because a lot of medicine and a lot, you know, we're a little bit on the side of, and not a little bit, but you know, treating disease where we should be, you know, promoting health. And so I think the Internet of Things, you know, people, and then you maybe throw in some precision medicine there, the genetic piece about what you need to watch out for, You know, we could be prescribing perhaps an Internet of Things or nanomedicine, you know, early on in people's lives so that we don't have to deal with the side effects of years of disease. Because that's, we spend a tremendous amount of money on the, you know, the side effects of disease rather than preventing it. And so, of course, the type of information that we're talking about, along with some technology as far as diagnosis goes, are that's a powerful a change right there. I'm excited about that sort of thing, as far as, you know, combining all that together early in a person's life rather than, you know, after they're already sick.
I mean, a simple example of that is, you know, you go, for those of you that are younger, you can look forward to a yearly blood draw, if not even more. And then you're going to invariably get a piece of paper in the mail that has a bunch of numbers and terms that you don't understand. And if they're all in between two different levels, then it might just, the last one I got just said, okay. And I was like, wow, that's remarkably impersonal. And I might want some of this explained, which right. then requires a whole nother set of actions. And like I said, I mean, some of that, I think you can probably, well, like I said, hey, your blood sugar is really high or your cholesterol is really high. Consider doing this or this. And, yeah. you know, some of that doesn't work. And I would imagine that can probably take up a lot of a doctor's time too. It's kind of like sure. redundant answers and stuff like that. Once again, with me today, I had Dr. Greg Ator from the University of Kansas Health System. Go Jayhawks. We're allowed to say that on this show. Right. Occasionally we get someone that wants to call us out for being Jayhawks, Chiefs, or Royals fans. At least two out of three were good this year.
That's right.
So, or looking good this year. So we have that to look forward to. I ask everyone on the way out. So normally we do what we call the founder's freestyle, but what's a little bit of advice or push that you could give to the entrepreneurs of the world that want to trend towards medicine and innovation?
Yeah. Well, I think as we talked about earlier, Matt, there are tons of problems to solve. And I think, you know, developing relationships with folks that are on the front line that have a very good idea about what the problems are, and then understanding how to kind of navigate and excel in the healthcare environment, you know, it's a great combination. We've got some very talented folks with the solutions and the techniques and tools to improve medicine. And then we just, you know, that we're talking about at our institution collision spaces so that we can get those two folks together or those two groups of folks together in an atmosphere that is conducive to, you know, to improving medicine. And, you know, you can develop, there are many other tasks in my, I'm a little biased. My son works for a healthcare software company as a developer. And I said, well, you know, you can solve many problems with software, but healthcare problems are some of the most interesting. And as you said, there is so much money to be saved and so many good things to be done that we're excited about the future of collaborating.
I recently gave a presentation to several hundred IT educators in the Philippines, and the main question was, you know, what should we push people towards? And yeah, I said, well, there's medicine and finance guaranteed aren't going anywhere ever. So if you want an easy bet, if you have to flip a coin, you'll be all right going one of those two directions. Doctor, thanks again for joining me. I appreciate the update. I know this was a really broad topic, so maybe we'll come back later and dive a little deeper into one of these. It was tough to try to get all these questions in such a short amount of time. So, hey, keep doing what you're doing. The world needs more people like you. I appreciate it, and I'm sure everyone listening does as well.
Thank you, Matt.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. Like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. 'Cause no one can do it, like we do it, like we do it.
we do it like we do it.